Welcome to the Jerusalem Chamber, a collaborative effort between four friends and pastors who sit down to discuss the Westminster Confession of Faith. Let's join the discussion.
Westminster Confession of Faith, Chapter 24, Paragraph 6. Although the corruption of man be such as is apt to study arguments, unduly to put asunder those whom God hath joined together in marriage, yet nothing but adultery, or such willful desertion, as can no way be remedied by the church or civil magistrate, is cause sufficient of dissolving the bond of marriage, wherein a public and orderly course of proceeding is to be observed, and the persons concerned in it not left to their own wills and discretion in their own case.
Hey, welcome, guys. It's good to see you again. Here we are in the Jerusalem Chamber. Welcome to our listeners as well. We have Sean Anderson, Kyle Borg, Joel Wood, and I am Nathan Eshelman. Today I will be sitting in Prolocutor Twiss's chair. I'll be moderating this discussion as we look at a paragraph that has some controversy to it. This is chapter 24, paragraph 6, and today we will be dealing both with the second reason given for lawful divorce, which is called willful abandonment, and also we will be looking at the relationship that those who are working through divorce ought to have with authorities over them. So with those words behind us, let's get started. Gentlemen, we've already looked at adultery as a biblical reason for divorce, but here is an added biblical reason. Our confession says that willful abandonment is something that is also allowed for a biblical divorce. What is this? What is willful abandonment?
Just before we answer, can we just clarify one thing? It's actually not called willful abandonment. It's called willful desertion, just to clarify. Go ahead.
So, gentlemen, if Nathan had actually
willful
read the Confession
desertion.
Of Faith, he would know that. So I think willful desertion, what Nathan is apparently calling his modern version, willful abandonment. Let me answer the easy part of this, and then I might just sit and listen for the rest of this episode and learn. This comes out of the context of 1 Corinthians 7, where the Apostle Paul is dealing with a situation. And the situation, if you read that chapter, is these Christians in Corinth are confronted with the question, what if, you know, we become a believer, but our spouse does not? What are we supposed to do? How do we navigate that? Is our marriage legitimate? Ought we to stay married? And Paul is very pastorally, if somewhat ambiguously at times, dealing with that situation in that context. And the Apostle Paul says that just because you're married to an unbeliever does not, by that fact, illegitimize the marriage that you have. And as he gives these directions and instructions, he encourages the believing spouse to remain with the unbelieving spouse if they are willing to do so. And in 1 Corinthians 7, verse 15, Paul writes, "But if the unbelieving partner separates, let it be so. In such cases, the brother or sister is not enslaved. God has called you to peace." And that has been understood, and the interpretation that Presbyterians take on that is that this is, as the Apostle Paul says, you are not enslaved. If the unbelieving party wants out, wants to be separate, wants to desert, wants to abandon, however you define that word, the believing spouse is not enslaved. They are free to have that marriage dissolved. And so that's kind of the context for this paragraph. Is Paul's instruction here in 1 Corinthians 7, 15.
And you can, putting yourself in a first century mindset, you can appreciate this. You know, if you had two people who were married and one of them converts to Christianity, that changes the whole dynamic of your family. And so the idea here is that, of course, Paul is encouraging to stay, you, the believer, stay with your unbelieving spouse, because you don't know if the Lord will use this as a means of their conversion, you as a catalyst to their conversion even. But if they want to leave, they may willfully desert the marriage.
Well, actually, real quick on that, Sean, when you say they may willfully desert the marriage, you are saying that the believing spouse may allow the unbeliever to go, right?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. You can't pursue. Like the believing...
Paul is not saying that you may pursue a divorce as a believer with an unbeliever. But he is saying that, yeah, you may allow them to go. You don't have to be enslaved to this.
Yeah. Okay.
This relationship, this marriage. Yeah.
The way you had worded that made it sound like the believing spouse is the one who is willfully deserting, but it's the unbeliever who willfully deserts.
Yes. It's the unbeliever. Yes. Yep.
Okay. So, there are times of desertion that are not in the mind of the confession here. What does this look like? Is this only, physical abandonment, or like we talked about last week with adultery, is desertion more broad of a word than just physically leaving?
I think that as we stated last time, I drew our attention to part of this paragraph, that there needs to be wisdom applied from spiritual leaders that are surrounding these relationships. The confession states adultery as a reason biblically, while at the same time looking at the larger catechism's expansive understanding of what all can be entailed in adultery without a clarifier. I'm not saying that every single reason listed in the exposition of the seventh commandment, I may have misstated that a second ago, seventh commandment in the larger catechism, is perfectly grounds for divorce, but maybe if wisdom dictates that this person is enslaved to this and unwilling to leave it to maintain appropriately the marriage. I think the same wisdom needs to be applied in regards to desertion. As my good friend Sean would say, I may be in the minority report here, but I'll go ahead and there is spousal abuse that happens male to female, or, you know, female to male as well. But let's go ahead and put the guys forward here. If a man beats the trash out of his wife every night, he is saying, I do not care about or love you or care about this marriage anymore than what it exists to serve me. And I think one could reach a point where they lose the right to be married to someone that they are functionally saying, I would rather that you be dead than be alive to maintain this marriage with me. So I think that, again, when we look at the issue of desertion, I know there was recently one church body who was foolishly in recent years on the verge of saying desertion is the one person, whoever leaves the domicile for any, you know, significant amount of time or some significant distance, that they're guilty of desertion. That completely, you know, is misunderstanding reality, where the one spouse just has to beat the other spouse out of the home and then they win. The church would uphold them as the one having been abandoned. And so I think, as we said last time, we want rules. We want to know what the parameters are so that we know how close we can get to being out of bounds but still be in bounds. And scriptural wisdom would dictate that every situation is different. This is what we you know, how is each case similar and how is each case different? And when it comes to these cases, each one is different, and various things need to be taken into account. And unbiblical wisdom would just say, hey, just give me a grid to squeeze all this through and click, 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 click. Yes. Click, 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 click. No, that's not how it works. It takes the multiplicity of the session. It takes counseling the husband and the wife and weighing what is really going on in the marriage. It also fails to take into account the ability that is developed by abusers to hide their abuse. And so people will say, well, they show up at church and they seem happy because the one spouse knows what the other spouse will do if they do let on that there's something going on. And so this is, again, that proximity issue of being close, of being in their life, of being in their business, so that those facades begin to crack and the reality becomes known. I've probably taken this way wider than Nate wanted to take it at this point, but I think we just have to be realistic according to Scripture and see, you know, that biblical wisdom needs to be applied in each case, and that's going to look differently in each situation.
Yeah, folks, notice out. We are not wasting any time on this episode. We're just jumping right in. I want to respond to some things that you've said, Joel, and I really do appreciate a lot of what you said, but I have to ask Nathan a clarifying question. Nathan, you said that there were times of desertion that were there were times of desertion that were not in the mind of the Westminster Assembly. Did I understand? Did I hear you say that right? Rightly?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And maybe this is just me being me and Joel answering it as Joel. But you know during the time of the writing of the Confession of Faith, there are certain laws on the books throughout Europe that that set parameters for what would constitute desertion. Like if a husband goes to war and is presumed missing, there's a certain time period that has to pass before a wife is allowed to remarry. Or if, you know, a husband goes out to find work because the family is in need and he never returns, is that desertion? And these were questions that were on the hearts and minds of pastors and magistrates and theologians during this time, because these were real realities that that people had to deal with. Several weeks ago, I referenced a book called Sex, Marriage, and Courtship in the Time of Calvin's Geneva, and it sets out a number of the laws that were put into place that constituted desertion. You know, if a husband leaves for this and he doesn't come back for a year, the magistrate will declare that, you know, he's either deserted or that he's dead, and the wife is able to be remarried. Those sorts of things. So I think that what the Confession of Faith is thinking is not thinking about times when certain providences separate a husband and wife. You know, husbands and wives during this time period were separated at times more frequently than what may be our experience, unless there's like military spouses that are listening. You know, there may be times when somebody has to go away for a year to fight a war, and you know, that's not willful desertion. But if a husband leaves the family for a year and says, you know, I just need to go do my own thing, I need to find myself, whatever that means, that is willful.
Here
that
I
can
am.
Be willful. That can be willful desertion. You know, so it's not as easy as just saying, here's a time period, here's a rubber stamp, as long as you can put that on. So I'm thinking about it in those contexts. What is the heart of why a husband or wife is gone? What is the purpose? What have they decided? Those
yeah, we don't have to be back in Calvin's Geneva. I mean, we can think of the contemporary issue of, you know, the Filipino expat, you know, laborers, where there's a massive Filipino community all over the world that is working primarily in service industries, That's a massive part of the Filipino economy. And families agree, okay, you're going to go live in Dubai. You're going to go live in wherever. And you're going to work because the finances there are so much better and it benefits us here. Now, if the one spouse says, you know what, I don't want to live like this anymore. I want to come home, you know, then you start to get into these issues. And it really does shape that word willful desertion. You know, if I'm enlisted in the army, if I'm drafted into the military, I don't have a choice. I'm going against my will, so to speak. But if a husband has a perfectly viable job in his town, but says, you know what, I need to take this job five states away and I can't move you guys. So I just, you know, then that becomes very realistic to us in our contemporary context.
Yeah. And again, it goes back to that wisdom that we're talking about. You know, you could look at something on paper and just say, well, of course it's this. But when you start asking the hard questions, you can really see what's going on behind it. So that's what I was thinking.
So with that, I mean, what I would say, it's not that that there are times of desertion that are not in the mind of the confession or the assembly. But I would say that actually these were in the mind of the assembly because they actually had laws. Pastors were talking about them. You, in other words, what would be really helpful is a study where, you know, you looked beyond the confession to issues of desertion that society appreciated and could understand that those fall within a broader category. So, you know, what I appreciate about Joel, what you're saying is, you know, just like adultery, it requires wisdom. It's much more than just a simple, the sexual relation act, you know, and in the same way is true with this willful desertion. And it requires people being connected to their churches elders shepherding the people.
I was going to say, you know, this cannot be separated from the second table of the law in my mind. You know, part of the sixth commandment is preserving our life and the life of others. You know, think about a woman who has a man who is threatening the life, either, you know, by verbally or actual violence. The actual violence being obviously the weightier of those two things. And she is told by her spiritual advisors, no, you need to stay. You need to stay in the marriage. You need to stay at least in the home. You know, there's at least the removal from the domicile for the preservation of life, or else we are encouraging her to break God's law. It is not one of God's commands to be married. It is one of God's commands to preserve life. And then the wisdom applied, you know, in a more deep way is this man merely using the marital covenant, or, you know, just frankly, it's being used as a contract at that point, to entrap that woman or that woman and children in a situation where he can enact his violence and bring threat to their lives? These are the things that we have to grapple with and interact with. We can't just say, you know, yes or no, or just, you know, lob the accusation of, oh, you're just trying to just, you know, study undue, you know, reasons for divorce. That is not helpful at all to the people who are trapped in these types of situations, or for those people who do have spouses that are looking for all kinds of reasons for divorce. It's not helping them either on that other side of the coin.
And I think, just to throw 2 cents in here, you know, I think some of the tension we're feeling is a tension that has existed in the history of the Reformed Church. These are questions that have been brought up. You know, even Nathan already mentioned Geneva and Calvin, and they had to deal with issues of domestic abuse. This was not unknown to their generation. And you actually see what I would regard as a tremendous diversity of thought, even within Reformed theology, on what are legitimate grounds for divorce. You know, Geneva followed Luther with adultery and desertion. But for instance, Zurich had an ordinance where not only was adultery and desertion, but they also left room for cruelty, where there's cruelty in marriage. Thomas Cranmer authored the Reformatio, which gave 5 legitimate grounds for divorce, which included adultery and desertion. And it's interesting, they would define desertion as a husband's absence for more than 2 years, an unwarranted absence. And also, if a wife is being abused, if she's domestic abuse, that is grounds for divorce. I think it was Thomas Cranmer or Vermigli who said if a wife is being physically abused by her husband, she ought to regard him as a mortal enemy and pursue divorce to free her from that. And so I'm not definitively landing anywhere here. I'm just saying this is a discussion that has a very broad context within Reformed theology. And where I think we can glean a lot is even these men, our forebears, tried to deal with this very pastorally. They were not immune to the difficulties that we even face today and questions about abuse and things like that.
And I'm very sorry, Nathan, to continue this even further, but I'm very sympathetic to the discussion. I'm very sympathetic to the pastoral concern, you know, as well as the social concern. I think where I am challenged a little bit is that I would prefer that we do more study and actually look at these historical Reformation teachings on divorce, and we improve upon our confession, as opposed to trying to fit the things that we sense are good and justifiable reasons for a divorce and shove everything into 1 Corinthians 7. Because that's not, 1 Corinthians 7 is not an umbrella that gets to cover everything that's not quote unquote adultery. And so, like you mentioned, cruelty, we should you know, do a real study, a careful study. And actually, it's not like we haven't already seen this being done in other NAPARC churches. So we don't have to reinvent the wheel, but I'm just simply saying that the NAPARC churches should get together and they should carefully study our Reformation heritage. And we should, be willing to improve upon our confession as needed, because, the confession is subordinate to the scriptures, and there are plenty of other scriptural material that has to be weighed and considered as it relates to the justification for divorce.
Sean, do you think the confession, when it puts forth this idea of willful desertion, is being very narrow? Or do you think, and I don't know the history of our standards enough to speak to this, the Westminster Confession is a consensus document that allows some latitude in a difference of opinions. Is there the possibility that they're intentionally being ambiguous? Yep, we recognize willful desertion, but they're not setting out, I mean, could it be that they're not setting out to narrowly define what that is?
Well, again, you have the proof texts that do give some direction, but, you know, we appreciate that they don't want to be tied to just the proof texts that are provided. That was something mandated by the parliament. But nonetheless, it's not helpful, because some people read the confession more strictly, and some people read it more, I don't know what the right word is, ecumenically or broadly. And so I just think that, I mean, there's a reason now we're getting into like the RP church, but there's a reason why we have a testimony. It helps to clarify controversies of doctrine, worship, discipline, and government. That's one of the purposes. And so I think that here's a perfect example, not unfamiliar to us as a denomination, but not just us, but other Presbyterian Reformed churches too. Everyone is talking about this. Everyone is studying it. And they find, and some people find this statement sufficient because of its narrowness. And some people find it sufficient because of its broad application. And some people find it sufficient because of, and some people find it insufficient because of its narrowness. And some people find it insufficient because of the broad application. So to me, it needs to be helped.
Well, the word desertion does have a little bit of a range. It's not just, you know, physical in the, you know, just looking at the word. Desertion. There is the idea of, you know, leaving duties or abandoning responsibilities as well. I don't know if, you know, if as Kyle's asking, if this is, this word was chosen as a consensus word, you know, but there is not strictly the idea of physical involved in the word. You know, there's obligations and duties involved in the word as well.
I would anticipate that, you know, when we're talking about, for example, issues of physical abuse, that our Reformed forefathers were able to speak very clearly and helpfully on those topics. At the same time, they're probably not using 1 Corinthians 7. They're probably using other portions of Scripture, and that would be really helpful. That'd be really helpful to us. We need to do the study. That's all I'm saying.
All right. Well,
that wraps up today's episode. I would nominate Sean Anderson to be the chairman of that study.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Any RPCNA listeners, please write the synod asking Sean to chair the study committee that he's recommending.
Nate is the prolocutor. Sean is the provocateur.
one of the difficulties within Presbyterianism, you know, behind the scenes for those that aren't involved in the courts of the church is. Often the one that says this thing is needed is the one who will be chosen to make this happen.
But to be fair as well, I mean, we are trying to get at there's two questions. One of them is, what is the intention of the confession and the assembly, right? But the other one is, you know, what does the Bible say about our contemporary context? And I appreciate both those questions, but they are distinct. And
the second is more important than the first.
That's right. I'm saying we should pursue both.
Yeah, well, that's helpful. I'm sure we'll come circle around again because it is a difficult paragraph. It does say, although the corruption of man be such as is apt to study arguments unduly to put asunder those whom God has joined together in marriage. What are some of those arguments that are common excuses for unlawful divorce? You know, the confession does say that, you know, hey, you know, we take time to put forth arguments for why people should
no
be divorced.
Fault divorce.
What are some of those?
I mean, and where do you go with that? I mean, how much time do we have? Our society is a perfect example of exactly what this paragraph is saying. People find any reason under the sun to pursue divorce. You know, I'm no longer happy. Okay.
What were you going to say, Kyle?
Nothing. I was just going to say, you know, that people put that forward and it's like, what's your happiness got to do? You know, is that the promise you made when you stood before for people and God and, you know, for sickness and in health, better for worse, and as long as I'm happy? You know, so you think about, you know, that's one that I've heard commonly and had to interact with people on. My spouse isn't happy. They divorced me. Things like, you know, our marriage is not pursuing my dreams. I want you to pursue your dreams. I need to pursue mine. This marriage is in the way. So kick the marriage out the door. I think Joel brought some up in the last episode and just the excuses that people come up with. Time would escape us, I think, but this whole idea, people find any and every reason to put away marriage, and they fling the door wide open, and our government, our society has allowed them to do that.
I had a pastor's wife call me the other day and say, please, I can't take this guy anymore. He's driving me crazy. I need some reason to get away. I said, listen, Rachel. You're stuck.
Rachel!
So
get
in
here!
For this very reason, this is why I'm very much leery of people writing out their own marriage vows or marriage oaths, because I mean, there are good time-tested ones that actually identify the things that ought to be promised. But if some people are actually saying things like, you know, I marry you and so long as I'm happy, I mean, that's what they mean. So I think that you know, we should at least be testing these marriage oaths.
So if somebody, Sean, you're marrying somebody and they read their own vows and, you know, they're like, I promise to always make you happy. You're going to be like, hold it. That's not true. You must repent of that.
Right, I would. Now. I would have helped them before they said it publicly. But so, yeah.
Some young people in our church attended a wedding, and the one person vowed to like bring chicken nuggets to the person every day, or something. I mean, just you know,
until they're dead. You know, until they're dead at 40.
You brought cheese sticks today. I'm out. You know, it's just it's ludicrous the things that people think are entailed in the promise of marriage. And I think the historic vow, and I think the vows that are made, this touches on a very important, or oaths. I'm not sure Kyle can rampage about that, I guess, but, you know, these things I think also need to be taken into consideration. You are covenanting with this person, to fulfill these things. And, I think that plays into the wisdom and the counsel and advice that needs to happen.
Yeah, and I think we've been a little having some levity with some of the excuses that people come up with, and some of them should be, I think, openly ridiculed and mocked. But there is also an aspect here where people do find themselves in extremely difficult situations, and it is easy, and I don't want to detract from that. You know, spouses who have to deal with a spouse who is in the depths and the darkness of depression, that makes marriage very, very difficult. And I can see why people would want to study that as a reason to get out of the marital covenant. You know, people can have spouses who are terrible at money management, or are struggling with mental illness or physical disabilities, things like that, that add a tremendous burden and stewardship into the marital relationship. And we need to be very sensitive, and we need to be very pastoral in the way in which we deal with that, but also very biblically clear. You know, as Joel said, the covenant that you made, it matters. You know, the promises that you made, they matter in sickness and in health, for better or for worse, in plenty or in want. We're going to see this through, and the church really needs to step it up. Pastors need to step it up to help shepherd people in those seasons and in those situations, because yeah, yes, some of them are mockworthy. You don't make me happy. Get over yourself, you know, but then there are other real legitimate things that you can see why divorce would be such an appealing door out of the marriage. But we need to deal biblically, faithfully, sensitively to those things.
Yeah. So the confession gives these two reasons, adultery and willful desertion. And then there's this really great phrase, as can no way be remedied by the church or civil magistrate. Is divorce a personal decision, according to our confession? And if not, why?
No, it says they shouldn't be left to their own wills and discretion. So, no. Okay, next question.
You guys are tough. Maybe I should have just let one of you be the prolocutors here. I'm still caught on the fact that I said willful abandonment, and you know,
we're embarrassed for you.
Yeah, someday I'm going to get around and actually read this confession of faith thing. It just seems like it's a really good document.
In light of this paragraph, my question is, what is veggie lasagna?
All right. So,
but of course. So the simple answer is no. People are not left to their own wills. I think that is a key point, and I think we need to do better as pastors and as elders, and we need to do better in shepherding our congregations and those who would be married to understand this principle. You're not left to your own will in this decision. You know, the state has an appropriate place to be involved in the recognition of divorce, just like the state recognizes a marriage. And the church has an important place, you know, as the church solemnizes a marriage, and we could maybe get into the theology of that, but whatever, that's what we do. So the church might also have a very appropriate place to walk through this with two people who would be pursuing divorce. You're not left to your own will. The state needs a part in it, has a part in it. The church does as well. And people need to respect that, but people don't, right? People just think it's my marriage, and I'm the only opinion and voice that really matters. And I think the confession in the Bible really says, well, that's not exactly how
the beginning of the state's disdain or just disrespecting of the nuclear family began with their unwillingness to enforce adultery laws and things like this. I think we've mentioned some of this off mic. Nate, you said something about Frank Lloyd Wright spending time in jail for unlawful divorce. You know, I doubt, even if you view marriage simply as a contract between two persons, you know, I doubt there's any class in contract law in any law school in the United States where marriage law is discussed, because it's literally the state has left people to their own discretion. I have a friend in Pittsburgh whose grandfather was a judge, and during the Great Depression and such times in history, people had come, you know, and, you know, all of society is crumbling, marriages are crumbling, and he'd tell them, you're too poor to get divorced. You can't afford to do this. Go home and work it out. I mean, you know, a judge would be canceled today if that were the case.
Let me ask this as the follow-up question. We don't want to leave this paragraph and say, well, we had fun with it, but we didn't really shepherd listeners at all. We want to shepherd our listeners. How is the church to be involved in the lives of couples heading for divorce? If the church and the civil magistrate are to be involved, and again, the quote is, can no way be remedied by, what is the role of the church in helping to remedy a couple heading in this direction, heading off the cliff?
Well,
give some pastoral counsel.
Real quick with that, as we try to understand this, would you say that the confession's statement here, the remedy of church and state, is that applicable to adultery, or is that only applicable to desertion? Is it willful desertion that cannot be remedied by church or state, or is it adultery and desertion which cannot be remedied by? Because I understand this as applying to desertion. I don't understand this as applying to adultery.
So grammatically, you're right. It would have to do with the willful desertion. So what is the role of the church and the state in, especially the church here? We want to be pastoral.
I think especially with the church, given the biblical context of 1 Corinthians 7, the departing spouse has to be an unbeliever. And so it would fall upon the church in going through this, whatever that desertion is, however we understand it, to pursue the course of church discipline if that person is a member of the church, and excommunicate them, recognize them as a non-believer if the need arises, in order that then 1 Corinthians 7 could actually become the legitimate grounds for that divorce to be pursued. But of course, the church also just needs a role in shepherding these people, and walking through it with them. And I also think there is a place for the church, especially for the sake of the innocent party, to really, and by the church, I mean the elders, to make a determination, you are the innocent party. You have been deserted in this case, and we recognize that you are not enslaved. You are free, and we're going to recognize that on your behalf, together with then the rights that would follow that, that you are free to be remarried. So I think that's some of where the church needs to be involved.
Yeah, as one qualification with that, though, we need to make sure that we don't let our views on, again, willful desertion push us into excommunication, so that we can justify being a divorce being with an unbeliever. You know, we can't, sometimes, and it just happens, we're all sinners. It gets in the situation where we tend to take one side over the other, rightly so, in a dispute, but we can then pursue, we just got to get them excommunicated, and then, you know, the Bible says they can divorce. That can happen. We can abuse our authority. So with that qualification, I agree with everything that you said. Further, I think we've said it a number of places, not only in this episode, but in other episodes, that, you know, a good offense is a good defense, and vice versa. So if we start premarital counseling, talking about these things and what the scriptures uphold, then we're going to better prepare people so that when they're tempted to separate or under not legitimate reasons, then we can actually come alongside and say, remember how we worked through this in premarital counseling? Let's go back to those scriptures. Let's work through this together. And that's another way in which I think the church can help remedy willful desertion.
Joel, do you have any thoughts on how the church can help out here?
I think some of it is preemptive in, each group of elders identifying within their congregation, what is the makeup of our congregation? Some who are closer to university or certain work settings are going to have more singles in their congregation. Some, you think of particularly more rural, small town contexts, are probably going to have a greater makeup of families. This is not an issue that's far removed from older saints as well. I've seen, sadly, many homeschooling families, as soon as the last child is done, the marriage falls apart because they've allowed an imbalance of the reason we exist is to raise up these kids. And, well, the kids are raised, so what do we do with ourselves now? So I think identifying the makeup of the church and then teaching each of those categories of people appropriately. We would encourage singles, don't try to find the right one, seek to be the right one. And that applies whether you're single for the rest of your life or you end up becoming married. Helping families train well and be discipled well, the couples heading into marriage, helping facilitate couples, whether it be through counseling or encouraged, social outings or whatever, to continue to grow in their relationship together after marriage. I think there's a whole discipleship entity here that is moderately preemptive, and also helps encourage couples and families in the church to find their own avenues of ministry to help other couples as well. There's nothing that says that counseling has to come from an elder. There might be an older couple in the church that is gifted in helping, young couples work through problems, and they should be encouraged to use that opportunity for ministry. So I think a preemptive discipleship approach to this, where you're building a culture that doesn't idolize marriage in some of the ways that have been decried at times, but upholds marriage as that holy institution that it is and handles it appropriately and views it appropriately, whether you're married or single, old or young.
And how about things we can do to help marriages stay healthy in the church, so we don't have to move in this direction, or so that we can move less in this direction? Any advice for our listeners on how to help support, encourage, build up marriages within the life of the church?
I think there needs to be, and of course, how you create a culture of a church that does this is perhaps the million-dollar question. But there has to be a willing transparency. Look, marriage is hard. We all know that. We love our spouses, but it's hard. To be joined to another sinner when you yourself are such a big sinner. And the church needs to be a place where people can air that. I know, especially in my context, many of the women are willing to share some of their struggles, but the husbands are all mum. I'm not going to do that. We don't talk about those things. That's between us. And
for our British listeners, Kyle is saying that they don't talk about it. Not that dads are mums.
That they're their mother.
Go ahead, Kyle.
We have British listeners. I'm so sorry. So
I think one
so
of our
I,
two.
I think.
Hi, Stephen.
I think we need to get rid of the stigma that, talking about these things is some sign of weakness or failure. We are to bear, the church is to bear one another's burdens. That's part of the glory of being the church of Jesus Christ. And marriage can be a burden, and we need to be willing to invite people into the mess of our marriages and have them help us and have us help them with theirs.
And again, just to qualify that a little bit more too, because what we don't want are gossip sessions or people just berating their spouse to other women. At the same time, having really good, being able to talk about the principles and then having maybe older couples or mutual couples that we can come together and talk about these things. I completely agree. Be open, be transparent. We're not telling people they have to shout their problems from the rooftops of the church, but at the same time, they have to be able to talk to somebody, together. I'll just say that. I think that is very important. I agree with you, Kyle. Hosting marriage retreats, getting husbands and wives away from the kids and just being able to focus on focused training from the scriptures, specifically on God's purpose in marriage, their duties. These kinds of things are really refreshing and helpful, and they reorient us back to what we're called to do and to be. Another thing you can do is encourage a couple to read a book on marriage together every, 3 years. Just something to help refresh and bring you back to purpose. Everybody needs to. I mean, this is why people have things like mission and vision statements. You have to get reoriented. You have to come back to the first things. And I think this is true for a proactive marriage.
And I think as well, so we've been talking about what the church can do to target specifically the leadership. Elders need to know how to deal with these things. And, I am so tired of the stories, even within our broader Reformed and Presbyterian circles, of pastors and elders dropping the ball when an abused spouse comes to them and says, I need help. And so many run around like chickens with their heads cut off. They don't know how to put the fire out because they don't know how to pastor in these situations. And if we are going to cultivate an environment where marriages can flourish in our congregations, the leadership needs to know how to pastor these things. And if people are part of a church where the leadership doesn't know how to do that, and I don't mean the leadership doesn't always tell me what I want them to tell me, that's a toxic environment in and of itself. But if you're in a church where the leadership doesn't know how to deal with these issues, go find another church where the pastor and elders know how to deal with it. Because these are very serious things, and we continue to see and hear story after story after story where these issues are not being dealt with biblically, faithfully, sensitively, and pastorally. And it's heartbreaking.
Amen.
And then any final wisdom that you want to leave our hearers with?
Sean's probably going to qualify something I said.
No, well, just what you're saying about resource, or what you're saying about leadership, so what resources are available to help leadership? Churchcares.com has a free book, Becoming a Church That Cares Well for the Abused, and it covers a multitude of issues, not just physical abuse, but also, emotional, verbal abuse, these kinds of things. And I do think we need to, we're talking about abuse. We've talked about it here and there, but we do also need to be able to shepherd the abuser, because they need the gospel too. And sometimes, we tend to, there's a casualty either way. We tend to help one to the neglect of the other, and that's not good. Chris Moles is, I think, a very helpful counselor, especially as it relates to helping the abuser. And if you have more questions, you can email us and we will get to you.
All right. Well, thank you, gentlemen, for your lively discussion. Thank you for correcting me on my misreading of the Confession of Faith. As always, you three are the superiors in the room, and I love you for it. Listeners, thanks for joining us in the Jerusalem Chamber today as we've looked at the Confession, and we do look forward to that time when the closing words of the Confession will be our reality. Come, Lord Jesus, come quickly. Amen.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Jerusalem Chamber. To become a full subscriptionist, head over to iTunes and subscribe to this podcast. Visit us at JerusalemChamber.com or drop us an email at thejerusalemchamber@gmail.com. The Jerusalem Chamber is copyrighted 2019.